So it's April 18th, 2009, and my name is Jan Rigsby, and this is a Pathwork teleconference on Pathwork Guide Lecture 130, which is acceptance versus abundance. And I thought the topic was timely, considering there seems to be a lot of creaking and groaning on the planet in terms of change, a lot of things going on at this particular moment for everyone. So in the title, normally on a Pathwork title, you can almost say it as shorthand. It's like a mantra. Some of them are just pithy sayings that encapsulate the entire tone of the lecture. One of the examples is the compulsion to recreate and overcome childhood hurt. That kind of says it right there. Another one that I'm fond of is leadership, the art of leadership. However, I usually get that wrong, and I usually call it the art of frustration. And people say, no, Jan, it's not the art of frustration, it's about leadership. And I go, yeah, the art of frustration. So sometimes you can tweak them a little bit to make them more meaningful for you. On this particular title, what I notice is the first thing the guide does in opening the lecture is challenge the very title of the lecture. I find that interesting because the titles are usually explanative of the end result point that the guide is making, and this one starts off as a discussion point. So the guide says from the beginning that in terms of acceptance, that there are two trends of thought. Sometimes I don't get my words right. There are two ways of thinking about acceptance. Okay? One is that we need to accept all. The difficulties, the positives, the negatives, everything. We just need to be accepting of all. And there's another train of thought that says that difficulties aren't necessary to endure. In other words, there's no particular reason why pain has to exist or difficulties have to exist. So from the beginning, when you talk about acceptance, there's a duality inherent in it for a lot of people. So what I do is, what I found in this lecture is to flip that around and to think of the lecture in terms of abundance in acceptance instead of acceptance versus abundance. So if we flip those around and we think of terms of abundance in acceptance, that's really what the guide is putting forward here. What he's saying is that when you can bring yourself to a place of acceptance of whatever is going on in your life, in your situation, you know, at any level you wish to work on this, that when you can bring yourself into a situation of acceptance, abundance follows. That abundance is a state of mind, and acceptance can be a state of mind. So that when you've got both of them moving in a fluid and open way, then you are ready to accept whatever is, that abundance will flow in and out of your life. But the trick is in and out of your life. So the next point the guide makes is he asks, is your willingness to accept based upon wanting positive, or is it based upon not wanting negative? Now, I'm not defining things because different people have different opinions of what's good and bad and so forth. So whatever it is to you on a subjective level, the question you might ask when you look at, are you open, are you willing to accept life, is, are you looking at the positive as a natural state that will come to you? Or is your acceptance conditional and an attempt to move away from negative situations. If your acceptance is positive, then the next question you would want to ask is, can you accept whatever is? So in other words, when we say we want to be accepting, we really need to look underneath that and ask ourselves if there are any conditions on this acceptance. So there's a place where we barter with God and we barter with Spirit. We will accept on the presumption that you will give me what I want. Okay? It's an unwritten contract. It's a barter. It's not true acceptance. So when you're not truly accepting, but you're trying to trade acceptance for good fortune, you're not being honest about the acceptance. You're trying to buy good fortune. And when your purpose in wanting to open your heart in acceptance is to avoid something, again, you're not being honest. You're bartering, you're trading. So to look at if there's any duality in you concerning acceptance, and then is there any duality in you concerning abundance? Now, this is a key point, because while we may seek abundance and pleasure, it needs to not be a demand. When we seek the good things in life, realistically, from a mature point of view, we need to understand and accept that there's an organic process, and there are good days and there are not so good days. And when we truly accept, we're saying we're open to the experience of life without judging what life ought to be. Now, there's another lecture that the guide speaks of this in. It's lecture 133. And it's about two basic misunderstandings and all concepts roll together, so I'm going to bring that in. But in lecture 133, the guide talks about two fundamental misunderstandings. And the first one he talks about is the misinterpretation of what life on this planet is intended to be. So again, what I'm speaking to here is that there are paradigms sometimes within what we say, basic assumptions that if they go unchallenged, we say, but I was open to life and it slapped me in the face. Well, sometimes that happens in life. That life is not set up to be pure pleasure, just like it's not set up to be pure misery. And I've said this before, from a human standpoint, we may wish to be happy, but from a spiritual standpoint, which is what the Pathwork lectures say we have come from to come into this life, our purpose is not to be happy. Our purpose is to learn and grow. And change, which is what learning and growth requires, change, is not inherently pleasant or pleasurable. But when we look at that, another duality that we want to look at is just because something isn't fun doesn't mean it's bad. So when we fight for pleasure, that's usually an indication that we're running away from unpleasure. Instead of opening ourselves up and saying, I'm going to do my best, I will expect the best, but I will take whatever comes at me. And there will be good days and bad days. And in the process of life, I will receive some challenges, and I may find them difficult sometimes. So the guide very often talks about holding a tight no. And energetically, when we hold a tight no, we bounce off things instead of receiving them. So all this is about taking a look at, in you, what you think when you say the word accept. I accept. I am open. And also what you say when you say, I wish to experience abundance. I wish to participate in the process that I hope will lead me to abundance. Well, the road may lead you to abundance, but it may be a long road, and it may be a tough road, and it may involve various challenges that feel painful and difficult and scary. But that doesn't mean that you're not headed towards a level of abundance. It just means that the snapshots that you might take at any given point along the way might not fit your idea of the ultimate goal of abundance. So, to bring that down to day-to-day activities, if you say that I accept who I am, on a joke level, take a look at your cosmetic counter. Take a look at your bathroom countertop. Take a look at your wardrobe. Take a look at how much care you take to present yourself to the world. And ask yourself, do you truly accept yourself as you are? In that acceptance, you might say, well, I do accept myself as I am, and I wish to convey an impression that is favorable, so I'm going to adjust myself so that I am received more favorably. That's not necessarily negative, it just is. The question would be, how do you feel when you are received negatively by others? Can you exercise the right to be received negatively by others? Can you have a bad day and engage with other people and feel, I didn't impress anybody that day, or I didn't behave well, or I looked really scruffy, and I'll bet they think I don't care about myself, but I do, just having a rough day, or I was out in the garden and I went to the shop and I didn't brush my hair and I didn't clean up and I wondered what they thought of me. That's what I'm getting at. So there's a place where you can look at some of the very, very basic and simple things about your life and ask yourself, could I do without it? Again, that doesn't mean you have to do without it, but it's a way of finding places in you that are not fully in integrity. Now, we're not quite as tight in society as we used to be 20, 30 years ago, where women were particularly vulnerable to this sometimes, where you couldn't go out without putting your cosmetics on. So there was a place where there was a face for the outside world, different from your own face in the mirror in the morning or at night. And we can feel unease about putting our real face out, especially if we haven't done so for a long time. Now, with all of us, that'll show up just as well in clothing. It'll show up in possessions. It'll show up in how our children are presented to the world, whether they're well-dressed and clean. At work, it will show up in terms of how impressive or prominent our work surroundings are. These are places for you to look at, for you to say, do I honestly accept myself? And do I honestly accept people's impressions of me? Because if there's a glitch there, then going any further, you're already in a lack of integrity at that point. So a lot of the Patrick lectures actually work on a very, very subtle, personal, intimate level to find the truth about whether we actually believe in a concept. So then the guide introduces the idea that in terms of acceptance, we can look at pride, self-will, and fear, which is Patrick Guide Lecture 30. And what I found was there's an interesting synergy here between pride, self-will, and fear, and paper, scissors, stone. So pride, false pride, because there's a yin and yang, there's a good and bad on everything. So there's a pride that is important and worthwhile and genuine and has integrity and is soft and vulnerable and open to change. But what we're talking about here is false pride. We're talking about a mask. So the paper would almost symbolize that. Or you cover over to give a different impression for whatever reason. And the false pride is dependent upon fear, because if you weren't afraid of what other people would think, then you wouldn't bother to cover it up. And the self-will comes in the covering up process. So even though you can name these three as separate, they aren't separate. They work together. So in looking at your willingness to accept, you can look at your how much false pride you may feel that you have. You can look at how much self-will you exercise. And by self-will, what I mean is will that is generated by your ego mind. It's not willpower that has decided this is an appropriate thing to do and I feel it should be done, so I'm going to put time and effort into doing it. Self-will is saying, I want it my way. And only an individual can very, very carefully tease some of this stuff apart and see whether it is truly an act of generous will that you're engaging in, or whether it's a self-will and it's cloaked by false pride. You can see how complicated this all gets. Cloaked with false pride to give the impression that it's honorable will, an honorable use of will, or a community sense of will instead of an individual sense of will. So again, in this work, it's very individualistic. It's very important that you find your place where you may not be in full acceptance, that you find the place where you may feel that there's some false pride active in your life, or the willpower to aim things towards positive abundance instead of a full range of life experience. And also notice if in your movement forward, you're actually running away from something. These are very subtle and small movements. So one of the ways you can, there's 1,000 exercises on this, on how to tell these principles apart. So one of the things you can look at is how much control you feel you must exercise. Any word that, or any feeling you have that this must be done is a good place to start looking. Because if it's real and true, it would be done sometimes, but not other times. There would be, I like to think of it like the tide. So the tide comes in and the tide goes out. And what we do as people very often is we try to capture the tide. I like high tide, but I don't like low tide. Well, but both happen. And just like the tide rotates twice a day, comes in and out, scours the beach, brings things in, takes things out, that happens in life as well. When we notice that we are insistent on one state of affairs and resistant to any organic movement from that place, that's an indication of control, which is a part of self-will. Another way to look at this is to realize that when you say, but I am open to negative experiences, I don't demand positive all the time, take a look for just a moment at an invisible expectation you might hold for, yes, I can sustain myself during negative time periods or unpleasant experiences for X amount of time. Because in truth, that's how we get through unpleasant periods. So Guide talks about at one point that you can sustain almost any pain if you know how long you are going to have to deal with it. So even if the pain feels excruciating, if you are assured that this pain will leave in 5 minutes, if your doctor says we're working on it and we're going to do this and that and the other, and you will not experience this after a week, and especially if we get support in terms of softening the negative results or support from our friends or our family, we can get through just about anything, especially with the assurance that it's not going to last. But when we enter into something and we don't know how long it's going to last, sometimes our tolerance for negativity, our tolerance for discomfort, our tolerance for pain plummets. Because the idea that we have to put up with this the rest of our life, or excruciating pain for a week, that may be outrageous. So it's one of the places where you can check in with yourself and see whether you are accepting of the organic state of a situation, or whether you have invisibly bartered with yourself or imagined that it will only last for 3 days. And so you're propping yourself up against the unpleasantness of the situation, assuming it will only last a few days. The lecture here is talking about a form of acceptance which allows a lack of pleasure, which allows difficulties, discomfort, even pain, without a knee-jerk demand that you know exactly what's going to go on and for exactly how long it's going to last. And this is one of the ways where you can sense underneath, what one term for this is, to sense underneath the higher self mask. And the higher self mask is just like any other mask. It's false. It puts on a sunny face and it says, I can be wonderful. I can sit in this meditative position. I can give to charity. It says it can do it, but underneath and invisibly, there are conditions. So it is speaking generously, but there is not a generous substructure. So all I've been speaking about is that when we talk about acceptance or abundance, we really need to look under the surface and see what we really believe in terms of our willingness to accept and what we really think abundance is. One of the, I think through various topics and what to bring in these lectures and examples to bring in, and one of them that I came up with is that most older people, and even that statement, most older people, let me rephrase that. Elders that we admire tend to have a very soft and generous view towards life. They tend to be open to, I believe the word is vicissitudes, okay? Open to the pluses and minuses of life, open to the fact that not every day is good and that there will be pain and there will be misfortune, but that it will even out. And one of the reasons they believe that is they've seen it. They lived through 60, 70, 80 years. And they've seen the averages, and they know sorrow, and they know joy. And their experience is that life is a mixture of these two. So they get to be an elder, and they tend to take things more softly. They tend to say things like, now, it'll be okay. And to emphasize and call forward positive aspects of a situation and downplay just a little bit. Yes, I know it hurts. Yes, I know you're upset. And show you some other aspect of what's going on. And so when I started off, I said most, and I had to change that because it's not a popularity contest that most people who get to be 70 or 80 years old are elders. But in society, we know the difference between elders, wise people, who are using their life experience, and people who are still caught up in the drama of day-to-day life, who are still frantic or frightened, who are holding on or insistent that there's only a certain way to do something. So the kind of elder I'm speaking of is the kind that basically says when they're about to die, they never say, should have worked harder, should have earned more money, should have dotted that I and crossed that T. The elders that we tend to respect in society reflect an attitude of, it was the loving that was important. And if I missed something, I should have played more with my children or my grandchildren. I should have volunteered more time. Should have read more books. Should have played more. So what I'm suggesting is that people who have gotten a certain experience in life, who have taken this and become wise about it, tend to say, enjoy life for what it is. Relax about life. Learn to play more. Don't sweat the small stuff. That's usually what comes from wisdom. So how do we become wise when we're 30 or 40 years old? You have to practice it. You have to work at it. And what the guide is suggesting is a way to look underneath what you might say and look at your deeper belief systems to see if you are speaking the truth or covering something up. Now, this is where I usually put two lectures together when I work, because it gives different... Oops, somebody was leaning on a key just then. When I put two lectures together, it allows people to go back and forth for different examples, speaking styles, different flavors of the same point. So the lecture I put together with this was mutuality. And in the lecture on mutuality, the guide starts off with the same analysis or way of analyzing, saying that there are two aspects to mutuality. One is creative spontaneity, and the other is mechanical, the day-to-day. That for us to engage with each other on a mutual basis, it both takes that eros, that energetic spark, that wanting to be a part of another person's experience, and it takes work. If you only do the work, it's not real mutuality. Because inherent in mutuality is the sharing of ideas and creative life force, of truly being with someone, of saying yes. And the reason these two lectures seem to mesh together to me is acceptance is also about saying yes. Not yes to pain, not yes to negativity, but yes to experiencing the fullness of life without trying to salvage something or hold back or fight against. An acceptance of life, including I'm going to do my very best. So just like in the mutuality, in my acceptance, I'm going to bring in my creative spontaneity and my joy and my yes, but I am also going to bring in my ability to change what happens to me. So if you imagine somebody going down the rapids in a river, okay, in going down, you might want to negotiate so that you don't get quite as bruised and get quite as cut up, and try to stay in the deeper part of the river and away from the rock. And to do that, you expend effort, and you do specific things at specific times. But you also need to flow with that river. So in both acceptance and mutuality, we're looking at the details of life, and we're looking at a positive flow. Rather than a positive force or grabbing, we're looking at a positive flow of opening those floodgates and letting your energy out and experiencing life as deeply as you can, doing the best you can with what's given you. And hopefully you get washed up on shore for a few minutes every once in a while so you can breathe, take a breath, relax, get your bearings. But we can't stay on the shore. Life is about being in the river, in a flow that is never fixed, never predictable, and is truly not fully under our control. So that's how the guide initially sets out acceptance and talks about abundance. Another aspect of this is to really get where you may believe that the absence of pleasure is keyed to pain or discomfort, because it really isn't. The absence of pleasure does not necessarily mean anything negative, because there's a place of neutrality. And what the guide talks about is a place where we are so afraid of pain and discomfort that neutrality makes us nervous. Where we don't want to be in a floating place of calmness, where nothing particular is happening. Where we crave the positive, once again, as a way to bring ourselves as far as possible away from the negative as we can. So the phrase he uses is that the absence of pleasure does not equal the abyss of darkness. And again, you're the only one that knows if you're running away or running towards, rather than sometimes in a period of time in your life, you may be receiving very little discomfort or negative feedback, and you may be experiencing a great deal of pleasure. This kind of acceptance is a way of opening even more fully to that experience. By sensing if you're afraid this won't last, and basically saying, it won't last. I understand that. But it's here now. And in this moment, I'm going to drink my fill, and I'm going to experience it as fully as possible to the absolute depth of my being. So that when the tough times come, I can sustain myself. So again, in my research, I came across something that at first it looked like a little game. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized that it was literally quite rich. So what I would like to do right now is I want to read two paragraphs. Now, this work is in the study materials that I've put on my website, so you can download these if you want to look at them later. But in this particular moment, I'm going to invite you to simply listen. And what this is this is an exercise that a psychology team dreamed up, and it is designed to develop sensory imagination. I find most people don't really need to develop their sensory imagination. They may need to practice it, and they may need to identify it, and they may need to accept it, but they don't really need to develop it as much as they might think they do. So I'm going to read these two paragraphs and invite you to simply hear the words and notice what happens to you in your body. Imagine in front of you a pure white plate with a lemon on it, resting on a table. See the glossy yellow of the lemon's skin against the whiteness of the china plate. Notice the texture of the lemon. It looks clean and fresh. There is a knife on the table next to the plate. Now imagine that you are picking up the knife. You hold the lemon on the plate with one hand, and with the other hand you cut the lemon in two, hearing the knife cut through the lemon and hit the plate. As the keen edge slices into the lemon, the juice runs out onto your fingers and onto the plate. The citrus odor immediately hits your nose, sharp, keen, pungent, juicy, and invigorating. Now you pick up one of the lemon halves. With the juices still dripping onto your fingers and onto the plate. Using the knife again, you cut a wedge from the lemon half and raise the wedge from the lemon half to your mouth and touch your tongue against it gently. Every taste bud in your tongue is drenched with the tangy lemon juice as your mouth puckers instinctively. Maybe a shiver goes up and down your spine and your shoulders shake. Picture for a moment the lemon, the cutting, the tasting, the smell. What I considered when I found this little exercise, and they go on. They go on, for instance, their point is to invite you to write your own version of this by having experienced one version to write your own. And the point of this is to encourage people to see that they can write a descriptive phrase, and it can be extremely simple. This is very simple. Write descriptive phrases that really activate their whole body, their mind, their imagination, all their sensory organs, so that they feel the enormity and depth of a particular experience, something that they may wish to remember. But what I found when I read through this and I looked at the exercise and I wondered how to present it, imagine the abundance that you may have felt when I read all those sensory descriptors. Now, it would be cruel to read this to somebody who was hungry, because it might raise up a lot more sensory items. But presuming that we're not starving to death, and presuming we're not too terribly hungry, the richness of this experience, where our entire mouth feels a certain taste that most of us can remember to some degree or another, that the pungent smells as they go through our sinuses, you can almost feel the sting as it goes through it. Our ears hear the knife hitting the plate and that slush as it goes through the lemon. Our eyes appreciate the contrast in texture and the contrast in color. And our hands appreciate the texture and the sponginess of the lemon as we roll it around and maneuver it on this plate. There is a quality in reading those two paragraphs of abundance. And so I invite you to consider shifting this lecture. And in the materials I put on the internet, there's another exercise for stress reduction, and then there's a suggestion for what you can do. That if you wanted to give yourself an enriching experience, you could write such a descriptive paragraph. And if you had the time and the materials and felt like it, you could speak it into a tape recorder and listen to your own voice feeding back all this information to help remind you of, for instance, a day in the forest, a picnic on the beach, dinner with your family, a rock concert where you are surrounded on a sensory level by hundreds or thousands of people and your ears are bringing in the noise and the rhythms are coursing through your body and you can feel the drum beat from the floor and the strobe lights are flashing. This is a rich experience. And what I finally realized, it was more important to bring forward in this session the idea that we can enrichen ourselves more easily than most of us are used to doing. That you can bring an experience to yourself of wealth by simply bringing up this kind of incident with, for instance, a plum or a pomegranate or a cone of fairy floss or cotton candy. That you can bring this up by imagining the sensory experience of lying in a grassy field and being surrounded by the air and the warmth and the sun and the smells, the moisture coming in from the earth, even the little hints that there's an ant or an animal or an insect. underneath you, trying to get out from under you. That these experiences that we take for granted so often are, to some extent, the richness of our life on this planet. And especially if you want to remember an event with a small child or a beloved or a warm family gathering or a gathering of friends. This is what I was referring to, that people who grow older and who become wise, which is not guaranteed for us, this is what they remember. This becomes what is precious. Not their bank account. Not the fact that they were worried one day and overcame a difficulty, although there's some pleasure in that if you can accomplish that. But even if one day there was a difficulty and they were not able to overcome it, if they went home and talked to a beloved or were able to be with their pet, or sometimes if you just went home and peeled an orange and sat and tasted the deliciousness of a single orange, that it brings back to you a lifetime of memories, of moments, when you did experience pleasure. And it assists you in balancing out the strain and stress of a particular moment. So that's why I brought this forward, is I suddenly got, this is abundance. Abundance is in the mind. And that's what I feel that the lecture is bringing, is acceptance is an attitude. Abundance is an attitude. If you think you don't have enough, you don't feel abundant. But when you feel that your needs have been met sufficiently, it doesn't matter what it looks like. It doesn't matter where you live or what you wear or what you do for none of that really matters. What matters is your attitude towards it. Now, I have a brief funny story about this. There used to be a program that was written by a pathwork person before the days of internet and a lot of these search engines, and life is a lot easier now than it was when computers first came together. And he wrote a program that permitted us to search the lectures on phrases. And this was a miracle. This was wonderful. This was a fabulous tool. We loved it. Very simple DOS program that doesn't really work with current computers, so we lost it. But it was adorable. And what it did was, if you typed in a word, it would print out for you the paragraph that that word appeared in as many times in the lectures as it appeared. So, of course, you had to be a little bit careful because some words are very common and some words are not. And it would print it out in very tiny 9-point type, 2 pages to a page. So for research reasons, you could type in a word and you could get 4 or 5 pages. It was an enormous amount of information in a fairly short period of time. This was nirvana. This was a miracle. It was the best thing we'd ever come across. We were all crazy about this program. And a helper friend of mine, who did not have a computer with this program on it, one day she said to me, she said, I think that attitude may be one of the most important principles in pathwork. Would you run a search for me on the word attitude? And I said, sure. So I typed the word in, and it comes up, and I had gotten somewhat cavalier about, in effect, I didn't pay attention. So there was information on the screen that was important, but I just hit print and went and did a chore. Came back about 15, 20 minutes later, and in my heavy-duty printer were 200 printed pages, 9-point type, 2 pages to a page. And the printer was out of paper and asking for more. So on the premise of in for a penny, in for a pound, I went ahead and refilled the printer and let it print out another 150 double pages. And then with this massive, practically ream of paper, I delivered this to my friend and said, I think you have a point. I think perhaps attitude is really important in pathwork. And I find that in these lectures as well, that although we have difficulties and those difficulties need to be addressed, that's a mechanical part of living, that our attitude is going to be the most crucial factor in how we approach things and how we feel about the end result. So that's my funny story on attitude and mutuality. What I'm going to do right now is I'm going to change the tape, and then hopefully perhaps there are some questions.